Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Good afternoon. I am John Jones on behalf of the Commonwealth, and we are asking that this court would reverse the Circuit Court of the City of Richmond's decision suppressing the fingerprint comparison in question here because the court erred in several crucial respects. Before I jump into the merits of our assignments of error, I think it's important to nail down the standard of review because it's very important in this case. The historical facts found by the trial court are binding on this court, or at least subject to significant deference, but the legal conclusions are reviewed de novo, and that authority for that is McGee from this court in 97 and Ornelas, which is the United States Supreme Court precedent from 1996. But, you know, this court summed it up well in Spencer. It's an unpub from earlier this year, saying that the trial court determines what happened, and this court determines the Fourth Amendment significance of those factual determinations.
And Mr. Jones, would those fact findings, this is Judge Huff, would those fact findings then include the court's fact finding that there was no probable cause or even articulable reasonable suspicion for the apprehension?
No, Your Honor. I mean, obviously, there are a lot of factual input that goes into those determinations, but the final determination of whether certain facts rose to the level of reasonable, articulable suspicion or probable cause is a question of law that is determined de novo in this proceeding. And so, as a result,
Aren't there some underlying facts, though, that the court found, went through and said they didn't know the defendant, they had no idea about outstanding warrants? I mean, those are all fact findings, aren't they?
Those are findings of fact that are relevant in the determination of whether there was probable cause or reasonable articulable suspicion here, Your Honor, certainly.
Okay.
But still, even with those facts, the trial court erred by determining that there was no reasonable articulable suspicion. I can start there. The bar for reasonable articulable suspicion is very low. Here the facts that we had that I think the trial court did find, and there was uncontradicted testimony as to these, Mr. Coleman and his compatriot were standing together on a housing development that was marked no trespassing, and as soon as they saw the officers approaching, they split up and headed in opposite directions. And the officer testified that they were acting suspicious. Obviously, the compatriot, and we didn't try to put this into the analysis, but I think it's worth mentioning that the compatriot did have drugs that he tried to discard in front of the group of officers that pursued him. But Coleman, he was approached by two officers, and they asked him to come over here. And given the totality of the circumstances and the lodestar here is what a reasonable officer would perceive here, they did have reasonable
suspicion. Mr. Jones, could I ask you about one of the arguments you made about the applicability of the exclusionary rule? You seem to rely on the Commonwealth's motion to reconsider to get around a possible 5A18 problem. But as I look at the statute 19.2-400, the Commonwealth appeal statute, it says that upon filing of a timely notice of appeal, the order from which the pretrial appeal is taken and further trial proceedings in the circuit court shall thereby be suspended pending disposition of the appeal. Does the Commonwealth under that statute have the ability to file a motion to reconsider an order that has effectively been suspended?
Yes, Your Honor. And the reason and my authority for that is it was fleshed out more completely in the Berry Unpub cited in my reply brief at 2017 Virginia App Lexus 343. But in that case, the court found that language saying that further proceedings are suspended is actually limited to the court not being able to go on with the proceedings as if the appealed from order had not been appealed from. And what happened in that case, if my memory serves completely, that there was a notice of appeal, and then the Commonwealth almost simultaneously filed a motion to reconsider its the trial court's action dismissing the indictments from the docket. And the Commonwealth thought that it was precluded from pursuing a Commonwealth's appeal because the action had actually effectively been dismissed. And so it didn't perfect its appeal until well after the deadline had passed. And this court, relying on West versus Commonwealth, 16 Virginia App, 679, found that circuit court's not precluded from reconsidering an order merely because the Commonwealth has filed a notice of appeal and that, you know, further proceedings in the circuit court, depending on what they are, may be appropriate. And so in Berry, the Commonwealth actually was found to have that they did not, they lost the ability to appeal because they didn't perfect their appeal timely, and their notice of appeal was still effective even while the reconsideration issue was
Mr. Jones, may I interrupt you? I think in reference to your motion to reconsider, however, that's not before us because you didn't appeal the order of the motion to reconsider. Would you agree?
No, Your Honor, I would not, because the Commonwealth's ability to appeal is obviously strictly limited, and we actually cannot appeal under the statutory scheme from a motion to reconsider denial. The motion to suppress and the order of suppression is what we are bound to appeal from. And so while
Mr. Jones, I should have been more articulate in my question. Ultimately, your issue and your motion to reconsider is not actually before the court properly, or am I wrong about that?
I would argue, Your Honor, that it is before the court properly, or else.
How clever of you!
if it's not, Your Honor, then there really is no way to get issues from a motion to reconsider in this posture, which this court has said may properly be raised before the trial court, up for review. And I don't think that comports with the spirit of Rule 5A18. And, you know, I made this argument in the reply brief, but the purpose of 5A18 is to ensure that the trial court has the opportunity to rule on arguments before they go up for review. And here, and in similar circumstances, that has been met, satisfied. And I think that the Commonwealth did everything that it could to make sure that the trial court had the opportunity to rule on that before we sought review.
Thank you, Mr. Jones.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I just encourage the court the Berry case and the West case that is cited in that deal with this issue a little bit more in depth. But even if the court isn't inclined to consider that exclusionary rule argument that we raised, I think that the most compelling argument that we've raised is the fact that there was nothing suppressible that was gotten, even assuming that there was a suspicionless seizure affected, that there was nothing suppressible that was obtained by that. And so,
but with that argument, we've got to deal with this Zimmerman case, which seems to suggest otherwise. I mean, the police would not have known that he was a convicted felon had they not obtained his name as a result of the stop. And it seems to me that Zimmerman is pretty compelling, even though I may not totally agree with the analysis, but it indicates that name identity is suppressible.
Your Honor, my best response to that, I think, is that there are important factual distinctions in Zimmerman, and where there is a basis to distinguish it, and the competing authority is from the United States Supreme Court, and then also very good persuasive authority. I would encourage the court to distinguish Zimmerman on the basis that all of the information, all of the evidence that was obtained of Zimmerman's wrongdoing was obtained by the illegal stop. Here, you know, we had the fact of identity was the only thing that was obtained by the allegedly, or I shouldn't say allegedly.
But without the name, without his identity, they would never have learned that he was a convicted felon, which to me is quite similar to the habitual offender status of the defendant in Zimmerman.
Yeah, and I don't know that there is enough factual development of that point for me to say yes or no to the I don't know that the record reveals one way or the other whether they would have been able to come at his identity by another means, whether by the co-defendant who had thrown the cocaine or by running the fingerprints through CCRE for a match search. I just don't know, Your Honor, but I don't think that the conclusion that you've stated is the only conclusion that the record would support. And so I would just, I guess.
But this is a status offense, just as habitual offender is a status offense. So what's the difference between his status as a convicted felon and Zimmerman's status as an habitual offender when it comes to learning that as a result of what might be an illegal stop?
I think the central difference is that they would not have even known that Zimmerman was driving, and finding Zimmerman in the commission of that act is what opened the door to all the other evidence that they obtained. Here we have an abandoned firearm with fingerprints on it, and those fingerprints are on CCRE for the police to be able to connect the dots. Whether I think they had talked to him and gotten his identification there at the scene or not, and so, Your Honor, I just respectfully submit that is a good basis on which to distinguish Zimmerman. So, the other issue that I think bears addressing is that. The seizure issue, I think that the circuit court short-circuited the analysis in that and gave far too much weight to the argument and to the subjective interpretation of Coleman there confronted with the officers, and also made, I think, at least one factual error that wasn't supported by any evidence in the record concerning how many officers there were. But, you know, this court is bound to defer to the factual findings of the circuit court, but when the circuit court goes beyond what the record supports and assumes certain facts that were not in evidence or that are contradicted by testimony in the record, the court is free to make its own determination of whether the supported facts amounted to a seizure. And there's a lot of there's a lot of authority for the proposition that that an officer who just approaches someone and asks them for identification or tries to speak with them does not implicate the Fourth Amendment in that action. I would just submit to the court that's very much what we have here. We have something that's unambiguously a request to come over here, and if you look at the Baldwin case, you have something that's a lot more overtly sort of aggressive in the hailing of the defendant than that case, and the Supreme Court still said that's not a seizure, and in that case it was accompanied by the use of a blinding floodlight. And there are a lot of there's a section that I referenced in my brief where they collected cases that referenced behavior that I think was more overtly aggressive isn't the right word, but I think the court understands what I'm getting at. That were still found not to be seizures, and so I see that my time is.
Can I ask you one last question?
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry, Judge Huff. Did you want to?
No, you go ahead. You may.
I know you're running out of time, but the question I have is, you're arguing that basically interest in the firearm because it was abandoned, no standing. Do you agree that if the abandonment of the firearm resulted from an unlawful seizure, that that rule doesn't apply? If he threw down the gun because he was unlawfully seized, then he still may challenge it.
Even to this point, though, he hasn't challenged it, Your Honor. But I think that if he were to challenge it, and he could show that it was the result of an unlawful seizure, that that may well impart standing. But the essential component of that that's not here is that he's never invoked ownership of that firearm. So I see that my time has expired, at least on my timer. So
it has. It has. We thank you very much for your argument, Mr. Jones. And with that, that concludes the docket and.